In the Healed Being program, I talk about the threshold. If you've hurt someone that you care about over and over again, they're going to reach their breaking point. Their threshold will be met, and at that point, either you have to change or they'll leave. And that's if you're lucky. Sometimes when the threshold is met, they leave whether you change or not. My advice, avoid the threshold at all costs. If you're doing behavior that hurts someone you love, work on it. Heal it. If you don't, they may not want to continue to be around you. If this sounds familiar to you and you'd like to do whatever you can to avoid the threshold, or if it's already too late but you still want to try to resolve things, healedbeing.com might be your best chance at reconciliation. Life presents the toughest challenges. Every day you are faced with decisions that test your ability to express who you really want to be in this world. We're told to keep saying affirmations and keep thinking positively, but what do you do when that stuff doesn't work? Welcome to the Overwhelmed Brain, where you'll learn to make decisions that are right for you so that you can create the life you want now. Hey, this is Paul Coliani, and I want to help you learn the skill set you need to deal with life's challenges in the most emotionally intelligent way. This show consists of my personal opinions and is meant for informational purposes only. Always seek a professional for your mental health and well-being. If you are new to the show, go to theoverwhelmedbrain.com, try the search field, and you'll find almost everything. I've talked about a lot. And if you have heard the show before, welcome back. I'm so glad you're here. I'm not going to waste any more of your time. I'm going to make this show sort of an email grab bag episode. So this will be one of my email grab bags. I probably have like 3 or 4 out there now because there's a lot of emails that I get that I can't get to. And some of them are about subjects that I've talked about before, and I don't want to make a whole episode on it. So this is one of those episodes. Let me start right off with this email. Hold on 1 second. Let me pull it up. These email grab bag episodes are really off the cuff. I don't write any notes. I just get the questions like it's a live caller. You know, it's a live caller, and the caller asked me a question, and I'm just going to try to answer it. So this is caller number one, but I'm going to be the person that's calling in. This person wrote, if someone is in a codependent, emotionally abusive relationship and cannot leave the situation, could you give some techniques or processes that might help a person survive, manage, and still have some meaning, peace, and happiness in their lives? Not an ideal situation, but for some people, there is no choice. I think it's possible, but would like some helpful hints. Thank you. That is one of the hardest questions to answer. That's like asking me, I would like to keep my hand in the fire, but can you tell me how to be at peace with that? I would like to continue feeling this pain of this fire, but I want you to help me be at peace. I know that's extreme, it's exaggerated, but if you're in any type of abusive relationship, then what you are doing is facing that fire every day, if you live together. And so giving you any type of advice to help you through it, I don't know if you'll ever reach peace. There are ways to live with somebody or be with somebody that don't involve interactions that lead to abusive behavior. But here's the thing, and this is a big problem, is that most abusive people, they are abusive because they want to control things. They want to control their environment. They want to control you, so that they get their needs and wants met. They want to be able to feel comfortable in themselves because they are trying to cope with life and challenge and stress and other people's opinions and disagreements or agreements. There's all kinds of things that an abusive person has to, I mean, we all have to deal with it, but an abusive person, the way they deal with things and the reason they're abusive is because they developed coping mechanisms when they were children that don't function when they become an adult. My coping mechanism when I was a child was to be the peacekeeper, the balancer, so that when somebody started getting agitated around me, I knew how to calm them down. I could say things. I could talk my way through things for other people or with other people, and it would help calm them down. I've avoided several fights in my life because of this skill, this tact, this diplomacy. So that is a function that I could use, but it could also be turned into a dysfunction, which happens a lot. When you have a coping mechanism in childhood and you bring it into the adult world and start relating to other adults, those childhood coping mechanisms don't always work. And sometimes they will get you in trouble, and sometimes they are abusive. You'd think that a peacekeeper would be a kind and generous and supportive person, and I believe I was. However, I was also a very judgmental person. I was critical toward other people. I had standards that I wanted them to meet. They needed to meet my perfectionist standards. And so they were never going to be enough. No matter what they did, they would never be enough for me. So I had this function of being a peacekeeper that turned into a dysfunction later on in life. And there's other things that were mixed in there. You know, I was a people pleaser, and I was highly jealous and possessive. There were a lot of things that were mixed in because of my upbringing. But this is what happens, is that an abusive person will learn how to cope, or as a child, survive. They may not call it survival. They may not think they were going to die, but we don't know. When we're children, we just don't want to be hurt. We don't want to feel pain or suffer. So we do what we can to survive, to get through tough moments or challenges or stress. And then if we don't learn good coping skills or healthy coping skills, that can turn into abusive behavior. So I talk a lot about that in the Heal Being program, and also at loveandabuse.com, where I talk about that on the Love and Abuse podcast. But let me just go back to this person. I'm setting this up to answer you because I want you to understand that you are in the fire, and the best you can do is step out of the fire. That doesn't mean I'm telling you to leave. I'm just saying you have to find ways to step out of the fire. And the fire, in this case, is the abusive person that wants to stay in control. And the only way they can stay in control is they are trying to make you do exactly what they want you to do so that you don't disrupt that control and where they feel comfortable inside themselves. Because control is a method of feeling comfortable. A process to help us feel more comfortable when we are controlling or we want to control something. It's like my mom on an airplane. You will never find my mom on an airplane. She says, if I'm not in control, I don't want to be there. She's okay if I'm driving and she's in the passenger side, but if you put her in the back seat, oh, she does not want to be there at all. She's better in a bigger backseat, I found out. If she feels a little claustrophobic, it's not going to work. So the airplane may cause that too. But claustrophobia is also feeling like you're closed in and you don't have any control. And so this is what happens, is that my mom doesn't want to fly because she feels out of control. She loves to drive, but if somebody else is driving, she can't even like close her eyes. She has to watch the road. In fact, she told me she can't even go to sleep and take a nap. She can go to sleep at night, but not during the day. She said something happened once, and it woke her up, and she said from that point on, she could never, ever sleep again during the day. Poor thing. And so that may be a control issue or just PTSD she's trying to deal with. And so this is what happens with people that have control issues. They develop these issues that they can't get past, and some people turn those issues into abusive behaviors toward you. I think what I said made sense. If it didn't, let me know. You go to my website and write to me. But what I'm trying to say is that this person who wrote, if you live with an emotionally abusive person, they want to be in control. maybe not necessarily control of you, but that's often how it is, but just control of their life. And because you are a part of their life, you become part of their process of control. And so if you're in the room, you are in that dynamic of control that they are creating in their lives. And if you're not in the room, they, you know, you may still be on their mind, but at least you're not visible. This is stepping out of the fire. And I'm not even saying that this is good advice. I'm not telling you that you just leave the room and you'll be okay, because the person in control is trying to control everything, the environment, you, kids if they're involved. And it's usually the closest people in proximity to them, not work friends, not other friends, not strangers. It's usually the closest people, because that's where they feel the most vulnerable. When we are close to someone, when we are intimate with them, when we are their parents or their children, they know us better than most people, so we feel more vulnerable with them. And sometimes, if they're healthy and safe, it's okay to feel vulnerable around them. If they're not safe, we don't want to feel vulnerable around them, because then we're exposing our emotional core, our most vulnerable place inside of us, because they know us so well and they know how to hurt us. They also know how to make us feel good, but they also know how to hurt us, and we tend to close up around those kind of people. So this is what maybe she's dealing with. She feels vulnerable because this other person knows how to push her buttons, how to make her feel bad, how to make her feel guilty, how to bully her, how to intimidate her, all kinds of things that you can go through in an abusive relationship. Hopefully not physically abusive. That's a whole nother level, but certainly emotionally abusive. And she also says it's codependent. So she could be like a people pleaser and he could be a taker. They get along because their dysfunctions are compatible. So this is another piece of the puzzle that, when completed, will create a completely toxic situation. Have I answered her question? No. I'm just kind of laying out this foundation that it is very, very difficult when you're in this situation to do what she said, which is manage and still have some meaning, peace, and happiness in your life. I can tell you what I did. I did this up until 19 years of age, when I lived at home with an alcoholic stepfather and a codependent mom and just a complete toxic situation there, because he was violent and aggressive, and he broke a lot of windows and glasses. And so there was a big issue there that, when I was growing up as a kid, like I said, I developed these survival mechanisms, these coping mechanisms, and they helped, because I had to learn how not to incite drunk dad behavior. I had to learn what it took to upset the person and not do that. And that made me feel a little bit more comfortable, a little bit more peaceful. And that's how I survived childhood. I found the things that ticked him off the most and made sure I never, ever did those things. So if you have a tendency to disagree with someone that makes your life miserable because you disagreed with them, and you want to continue your life with them because, like you said, you have no choice, which, you know, you may have a choice, you just don't like the choice, but let's just say that you're not ready to leave, what can you do? Well, that is one thing. You take your hand out of the fire, you're going to do things that don't tick them off, or not do things that do tick them off. You have to get rid of the stimuli. What is the stimulus that causes them to do the behavior? That means you have to be very aware, very observant. When I do X, they do Y. When I say hello, they look annoyed. Maybe I shouldn't say hello anymore. But if you're living with a gaslighter, someone who likes to make you feel crazy, you could say hello one day and they'd be annoyed, and then you stop saying hello, and the next day they say, "Why didn't you say hello?" Is there a problem? Now you're in a situation where you can't win. And this is something that when you can't win, there's really nothing you can do. I mean, this is either give up and give in and do everything they ask, which still isn't enough, or get out, no matter what the cost. This is something I really can't guide you in, because I could tell you to leave and maybe that makes them madder and causes more problems. Or I could tell you to stay and that makes them mad and causes more problems. That's why on my show Love and Abuse, which I highly recommend you listen to, because you're in an abusive situation, I talk about all kinds of things you can do to at least communicate in a way that's healthier. Because I like giving people the opportunity to reply from an empowered place, meaning even the abusive person deserves the opportunity to reply or comment or talk to you from an empowered place. And they often feel disempowered, so they become hurtful. How can we empower the abusive person to feel like they don't have to control anymore? And I'm not saying that you should just start treating the abusive person with kindness and generosity and support and respect. I'm not saying that you should give them a free pass. I mean, I've had people write to me and say, I can't believe you didn't tell that person being abused to leave. And when they tell me that, I say, you can't just walk into a domestic violence situation and say, hey, you, the one getting hurt, you need to leave right now. In fact, domestic violent advocates tell you not to do that. Because if you do that, it could make things worse. It could get them hurt. That's why I don't ever say, hey, leave, unless your life's in danger and you have to leave, which means you have to set up an escape plan and all that. But in this case where she has to stay, she feels like she has no choice, then you do have to find out what the stimulus is. And if you can't, if you take out the stimulus that causes that person to react, and it's still not enough, it will never be enough. This is the part where I disappoint the person asking, because it'll never be enough. I could tell you exactly what to do, and tomorrow it won't apply. Today it might work, but tomorrow won't apply, because there are some people that just want to bring you down and take your power away from you. The people that want to take your power away from you, this is what I was saying. You can give them an opportunity to act differently, show up differently. And if they take that opportunity, great. And the way I give someone the opportunity is to let them know they're hurting me. So if I were in your shoes, assuming that this other person isn't a physical or violent person that will physically hurt you, you give the person the opportunity to respond from a place of empowerment by saying, do you realize when you do that, it hurts me? This is their opportunity to shine. Because what's going to happen is they're going to say either yes or no or something else. Yes or no, we can address that, but the something else will probably be along the lines of, you hurt me. I hurt you? No, you hurt me. Do you know that you hurt me? That's what they're going to say if they don't say yes or no. If they say that, if they say, you hurt me, then you can say, I didn't realize that. I'm more than willing to discuss that, but do you know, you go right back to the question, that what you're doing hurts me? Now, they may never answer yes or no. They may just keep looping this to keep you disempowered. And that's going to be tough, because if they never answer the question, which I say always come back to the question, do you know that doing this is hurting me? If they never answer it, then you're not going to get anywhere with them. That is their opportunity to have a real conversation with you. But if they don't answer the question, you know that they're not going to have a real conversation with you. They just want to take your power away so that they feel more powerful, so that they're in control. But if they say, yes, I do know that it hurts, or I didn't realize it until now, this is where the empowerment comes in. This is where you say, now that you know, will you please stop doing it? If they care about you, if they love you, if they want you to be happy, they're going to say, absolutely, I don't want to hurt you. I don't want you to feel hurt. If they're maybe not so caring and maybe they're just not very nice and they say, yes, I know it hurts, but I have to do that because I have to make sure that everything goes well in this family. I have to keep things in line. If they say that, you know where you stand and you won't be able to get out of that dynamic until you get out of that dynamic. Again, I talk about this at loveandabuse.com, and I highly recommend you listen to that show. But I wanted to address this message, which I thought would be really short, but I just droned on and on about it. But this is a tough situation. I definitely feel for you, and I know there are people in this predicament. And when you're in this predicament, you give the other person an opportunity to act from a place of empowerment, and that place is knowledge. You give them the knowledge. Do you know that when you do this, it hurts me? And if they finally know that it hurts you and they continue to hurt you, now you know that they continue to hurt you and they know they're doing it. Now you're in a dangerous situation because now you're with what I call a conscious abuser. They're very conscious what they're doing and they keep doing it. That to me is scary. And it should be scary to you. Because if you're with somebody who's consciously hurting you, emotionally, verbally, physically, whatever, if they're consciously hurting you, if they know they're doing it and they keep doing it, there's no stopping them. You can't get out of that dynamic unless you get out of that dynamic. And that is taking your hand out of the fire. And if you feel like you have no choice and you have to stay in that situation, then again, listen to my episodes on loveandabuse.com and you'll get something out of that, I hope. I'm so sorry you're going through that. And the best I can suggest is to keep yourself busy doing things that you like, assuming that it won't be a problem for them. If doing things that you like is a problem for them, and you can't get away from them, and you can't hang out with friends, and you can't go to your own space in the house or whatever, then what you're dealing with is somebody who's basically controlling every aspect of your life. And if you have to deal with that, then I'm trying to picture myself in your situation. My girlfriend was or just started being abusive and I couldn't stop her no matter what I said, and she was just awful, 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 and I had no choice but to be here. I would tell her, I'm sorry, I don't know how to show up for you that satisfies you. I don't know how to do that. Maybe I'm not the right person for you. Maybe this shouldn't be. Maybe we shouldn't have this because I can't show up in a way that satisfies you. But that's me. I could say that. I feel comfortable in myself to say that. I'm not afraid that my girlfriend would do something that harms me. And that may not be how you feel. So I would just stand up for myself and say, well, if you don't like it, then leave. That would be my position. If you don't like it, leave. Or I'll leave. Let's sell the house. You take your half, I'll take mine, and we'll go our separate ways. If this relationship is this difficult, we'll go our separate ways. But then people are going to say, I have kids. We have commitments. We have all this investment together. And this is where you think you have no choice because you don't like the choice that you have. And I've heard from many people that left broke, got broke because they left, and were still happier because of it. It's a very personal choice, a very big step, big leap of faith. But I look at it this way. I'm either going to spend the rest of my life with somebody that apparently hates me, or I'm going to move on and figure things out. I can stay and know what I'm getting every day. It's a known, uncomfortable place. Or I can leave, which is very uncomfortable too because it's the unknown. But at least I know that I won't be there anymore. And that makes me feel better. I feel better jumping into the black chasm of nothingness, which is the mystery. I feel better jumping into the mystery of leaving than staying in the misery of being with someone that apparently doesn't like me at all. That's how I feel about it. Let's go to the next email. Maybe I can get through this one a little faster. And that was a tough subject, that topic It's very tough. This next email says, what is this? Workplace egos, when people seem to puff themselves up and marginalize others. This is kind of a pieced together email. Cliques at work and teams not communicating with one another. When you're new like me, you are not in the clique, so it's easier. I'm not sure how this person wrote. How do I be a part of a clique when the rules are unwritten and not said? We make a decision who joins based on first contact, first impressions. Are they like me? But harder to get working together as one voice. We need to build bridges, channels, conduits between the teams and faithfully be people or even This is a very tough to read email. I apologize for the person who wrote it. I can't read some of this. This is what happens when I'm doing things off the cuff. I haven't rewritten it to be something that I can process. But this person is basically, it seems like they're asking how to be the new person in a group of people that has cliques. I think everyone is different here. If you walk in as a new person and you're an introvert, it's going to be a lot more difficult. And if you walk in as an extrovert, you're going to say, hey, my name's Paul. How's it going? Except you'll use your name. But it's interesting that I just read an article yesterday on how to make friends. And they said the way kids make friends with each other, because they did some studies, they asked kids, the way they found out that kids made friends with each other is that when they were seated next to each other. That's it. They said that was the main factor in making friends, you know, when they're growing up in school or wherever they are, is that when they were seated next to each other. I said, that's fascinating. And if you think about the friends that you made as you grew up, how did you come to make those friendships? I remember sitting next to a couple kids in my class that I made friends with. And I made friends with them because we sat next to each other. And, you know, you say things to each other back and forth and you talk about certain things and then you start finding similar interests and suddenly you're hanging out because there's a comfortability in being next to that person because it's almost a shared experience. I'm sitting next to this person and sitting here next to this person is a shared experience. We have a similar perception of the room. We have a unique perspective from our location. If there's a window there, we're looking out the same window. If it's in a classroom environment, we see the teacher from the same viewpoint. We may not understand things the same or look at things the same, but physically, we're in the same location and we're next to each other. And we feel like maybe there's a little bit more power in being with someone else. Not power, it's not a good word for it, but we just feel a little bit more comfortable because there's someone else there. And maybe at a deeper unconscious level, if there were danger, we would feel like the person next to us might be helpful if there were danger involved. So that's what they said in the article, is that when kids were sitting next to each other, they were more likely to be friends and sometimes long-term friends. And so I think about all the friends I've made, mostly at work and a couple at school. And when I was skateboarding and inline skating and very active outside, I would meet those people. So we had similar interests. And so these are the ways I made friends. So when this person writes and talks about cliques, how do I be part of a clique? I think it has to start with a single person. I mean, does anybody want to be part of a clique? Well, maybe you do. It's just a group of people. They all like each other. They all talk to each other. They gossip, probably. Maybe not. But some cliques do, some groups. But it starts with a single person. And what do? You put yourself in situations where you are around that other person. I think the movie Speed talks about this. The movie Speed with Keanu Reeves. I won't tell you the end, but there's a part where Keanu says, what did he say? He said, dangerous situations tend to bring people closer together when they share. Oh, yeah, that's what it is. They share dangerous situations. It tends to bring people closer together. And I thought that was an interesting line in the movie. It's probably taken from psychology or something. But it's a fairly true statement. if you go through something with somebody, something hard, something maybe dangerous, something that you're investing in together, not necessarily monetarily, but investing your time and your energy, you're more likely to develop a friendship that way. So when it comes to work, you may end up being paired up with somebody, or you may volunteer to help an individual person. But I wouldn't necessarily say go into the clique and introduce yourself. I would just start getting to know a single person. And not even getting to know, just being near them and doing your thing, and maybe doing your thing with them. You know, hey, can I help you with that? Great, thanks for helping me with that. Oh, what's your name? My name's Paul. So on and so forth. So that's the best I can answer. I'm having trouble with this particular message because it's a little cut up in pieces, but I hope that helps anyone that might be in that situation. Oh, that reminds me. I was thinking, what could I make this episode about today? And I thought, what if I made an episode on what it takes to rise up the ranks in your job, or at least what I've done to kind of put myself in a position to get a raise or a promotion. And I thought, nobody wants to hear that. And then I also thought, maybe everyone wants to hear that. So I thought of a couple things. I'm not going to make this show, this episode, about that, but I wanted to throw that in here as part of this variety episode. One of the things, or one of the pieces of advice that I heard, yes, I'm moving on to the next subject. One of the pieces of advice I heard about working your career, or being in a job and lining yourself up to get a promotion or a raise, is this first piece of advice, which is outgrow your position. I think that's how that person said that. He said, outgrow your position. And what he meant was get so good at what you do that you're bored about what you do and you have no choice but to expand what you do and learn more about what you do and learn even more so that you are overqualified for what you're doing. I thought that was a great piece of advice. I've used that whenever I was working anywhere that I had a boss. I'm my own boss now, but when I was working for someone, I would get so good at what I did. I would learn the ins and outs that I would become overqualified for my position, and people would notice it. And when they noticed it, they thought of me when it came to promotion or a raise or anything like that. And I did. Every place I worked, I would eventually rise up. I would rise up in the ranks, or, you know, whatever, different department. And really kept my career going. I didn't get burnt out because I was always expanding myself. Now, this doesn't always work. You know, you might work at a place that you have overqualified yourself and people don't care. If they don't care, that's tough. I don't want to be in a place where somebody doesn't care about me. But if they do care, great. Or if they notice it, that's even better, because they notice you are expanding yourself and are still doing the position that you're hired for, but they realize that you have more potential. So what you're doing is you're basically exceeding the potential for the position that you're in. And when you can do that, and you can show up as that person exceeding their potential, that gets you in alignment with another position, another department, a promotion or raise, typically. You know, this may not work everywhere, but that's what happens typically. Young people, listen up. Older people like me may already know all this, but definitely helps to overqualify yourself or become overqualified so that you are, if you want to rise up, so you're in line for a raise or a promotion or something like that. That's my first piece of advice that I received from someone else. The next piece of advice is something that I thought of that probably others have too, but this is something that just popped in my head one day, and that is find the stress that your supervisor or your manager goes through and try to help them alleviate that stress. So if your boss has to have a report on someone else's desk every Monday and it always stresses them out, can you help with that report? Can you do something to alleviate their stress. I think that's helpful. I think that when you can alleviate someone above you or someone that you work with that has a little bit of authority, if you can help them with their job, then you might be favored. You might be lining yourself up for another position or another raise. So there's another piece of advice. A third piece of advice is to make sure that if you want to receive more money, that you are working at a level that qualifies for that amount of money. I didn't say that perfect, but I don't have my notes. But I didn't say that perfect enough, because what I'm saying is if you make, let's just say that you make $10 an hour. I hope you make a lot more than that, but I know there are people that do. If you make $10 an hour and you want to make more, you want to make 12 or 15 or 20, then what you do is work as if you are already making that. What does that mean? You become indispensable. You show them that not only do you know how to do your job, but you do it great. You show up on time. You do your job well. You get along with people. You do a job so well that people will think that they are paying you more. And what that does is when you get the raise, let's call it when, when you get the raise, they'll already see you as worth that much. So the raise will be a no-brainer. That's normally true. Depends on who you work for. Depends if they're giving raises. It depends on a lot of things. But I'm just trying to help you line yourself up for the best chance at getting a raise or a promotion if you want one or if you need one, you know, whatever. These are opportunities to make changes if you aren't already doing this. Because I know there are people listening now that will say, I'm already doing this and nothing is happening. Well, this is my fourth piece of advice. If nothing's happening, it probably won't until you ask for it. And then it's either going to happen or it's not. And if it doesn't, then you now know that it won't. It's not a good way to say it, but that's exactly what will happen. It's not going to happen until you ask for it. And when you ask for it and they say no, then it probably won't ever happen. If they say yes, then great. But you also have to be prepared, and this is not so much advice, but a philosophy that I follow. You also have to be prepared to walk away from something that compromises your integrity. This is not advice. This is just my philosophy. If I'm working for someone, like if I had to quit what I was doing now and work for someone else, let's just say they were paying me $15 an hour and I wanted more, but they haven't given me a raise in 2 years. So now I'm thinking, you know what? I deserve a raise and I've been here a long time. The work I do, three other people would have to do if I wasn't here. I need a raise. So what am I going to do about it? Well, if I go ask for a raise, they might think I'm complaining and they might even fire me because maybe I'm causing trouble. How am I going to overcome that? I'm going to remember that my integrity is the most important. So I'm going to walk in the office and say, look, I've been here 2 years. I've waited. You haven't given me a raise. I think it's time. I say it with confidence because it's true. I think it's time. I think it's time to give me a raise. What are you going to do? Let's talk about this. And hopefully they'll say, you know, you're right. Let's do this. If they say, well, you know, we're working on moving things around and transitioning, and ever since the acquisition, blah blah blah, I'll say, you know, that's all true, and I still need a raise. I still need one. So I'm going to leave it in your hands. You know, make it happen. I may not use those exact words, but that's me, because I am not going to compromise my integrity any longer. So I put myself in a position that I know might be a little risky, but going and asking for a raise that you deserve shouldn't be risky. And if it is, why work for that person or entity? It shouldn't be risky. It should be something that is normal. Hey, you know what? I've been working here for a year and I believe I deserve a raise. Will you give me $3 more or $5,000 more a year, whatever? You just go in and you're confident and you do it because you know you deserve it. You know you're worth it. But also know that not everyone's going to be receptive to that, and sometimes there's risk. The risk may be them saying, well, you know, we're not going to give you a raise, so you can quit. They might say that because they don't want to fire you, because then they have to pay you unemployment and all that stuff. There's another thing to think about. If they fire you, there's unemployment. If they make you quit, well, let's just say that you won't be able to claim unemployment because you quit. A lot of people know that. Some people don't. Maybe I shouldn't be saying that. Maybe somebody's listening now saying, don't tell people that. But it's good information. I think it's good life information, because somebody that makes you quit is doing so for a reason. Hey, you know, because somebody did that to me once. They said, just sign here saying that you're quitting because it's a lot easier, or, you know, we don't want any bad blood between us. I don't know what they said. There was some lame excuse, and I was young, and I said, okay, I'll sign. And I just signed that I quit, probably so they didn't have to pay unemployment insurance or whatever. And so ever since then, no, you're not going to make me quit. I'm sticking around until you fire me. And then I'll claim unemployment until I get another job, because you're firing me. That's your choice. I don't want to deal with that. So anyway, there's my pseudo-expert career advice. I have actually used all of these in every job that I've been in. There's something that I hope helps you, just in case you're in a position that you need it. Now we're finally going to take a break one more time, one more segment. We'll be right back after this. I am totally digging the deeper sleep I'm getting now. Listen to this. I'm taking something called Magnesium Breakthrough, and I didn't honestly expect results this fast. It's not that I fall asleep faster, but I'm actually sleeping deeper than I can ever remember. To be honest, I have to get up once or twice a night to go to the bathroom. You know, I'm a guy in my 50s. It happens. But I'm waking up from a deep sleep and going back into a deep sleep when I'm done. That is phenomenal. That's a good thing. So if you have any issues staying asleep or getting enough deep sleep, I highly recommend Magnesium Breakthrough. We're told we're supposed to get at least 7 hours of sleep every night. And not only that, if you're not getting enough quality sleep, we're increasing our risk of disease. And we've all experienced brain fog, so we know how important it is to get a good night's sleep. Since most magnesium supplements are not full spectrum, you can't just use any old magnesium to fix a magnesium deficiency. You must get all 7 unique forms of magnesium if you want to experience its calming, sleep-enhancing effects. That's why I'm taking this Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers. I'm amazed at how much better I sleep, and you'll be amazed at how much more rested you feel when you wake up. Bioptimizers is offering listeners of this show up to a 42% savings if you go to magbreakthrough.com/overwhelmedbrain. I'll repeat that, magbreakthrough.com/overwhelmedbrain, and you can use the code BRAIN10 when you're checking out to get the savings as well. Think about what a good night's sleep, night after night, is going to do for you. Welcome back. I'm going to read you one more message. Actually, I'm not going to read it to you. I'm going to convey it through my own filters, because I read this message and it was a little long, but the general question behind the message is, I've been dating this person for a while and now they're being a little bit aloof, they're being a little bit distant, and they're telling me I think I want this to work, but I'm not sure, and they're not holding hands anymore, and it goes on and on about how the relationship seems to be fizzling out, even though they had a great first, you know, 6 months or so. And I thought, okay, I probably should comment on this, because I think this happens to a lot of relationships. One of the things I've noticed, you know, doing what I have been doing for a long time now, being a behavior and relationship coach, I've noticed that when there are words such as, I just don't know, I'm not sure, we could talk about it, and let's meet some night and we'll talk about what's going on in our relationship. We'll talk about where it's going. I don't feel close to you as I did, or something like that. There are words that don't give you any conclusion. They don't close any loops. They keep the door open. And these words, what do you do with them? How do you interpret them? You feel like you're stuck in the middle, like you're in between an answer of either I don't want to be with you anymore, or the other side, which is let's make this work. So this is typically for romantic relationships, when you're in any type of relationship and there is ambiguity in your communication, especially from one side. Usually it's this. It's one person saying, but I love you so much. Let's get together. Let's stay together. Let's, move through life together. Hold hands, walking into the sunset together. The other person, and this is the scenario I'm talking about, the other person doesn't feel that way, or is not sure they feel that way, and they don't know how to convey what they're feeling. So I have an opinion on this. It may not be 100% correct, but it's an educated opinion from my many years of working on this. And that is, there's already something that the other person knows that they are either afraid to share or can't face themselves to share, because it means a truth in their life they may not be ready to face, or a truth that they don't want to share because it would create conflict and they don't want to hurt someone's feelings if it's bad news, for example, or something else. But it's a truth that's not coming out, but it is being said passively. So there are passive comments, or there are indirect comments, very non-specific comments. Like, it hasn't been the same since, a few months ago. And then the other person will ask, well, what changed? And they'll say, I don't know what changed. I just don't know. Or they won't even say those things. They'll just act more distant. And so the person that really is into the relationship now has to face this confusion, unsure of what is going on and where should they invest their time. How should they fix this? How should they approach the other person? What should they say to the other person? And so in my experience, I'm just kind of sharing this, that it may not be true all the time, but there's usually a truth that the other person, the person being ambiguous, already knows that they're not sharing. And I will say this, there's sometimes a truth that they don't know that they know that they're not sharing. And so I like to put out a truth test. This is my truth test. Let's just say my girlfriend was doing this to me. She was distant and she couldn't figure out why, and she was no longer intimate. I mean, it would be difficult for me to actually go through this scenario, because we're very honest. If there was no more love between us, she would say, look, there's no more love between us. She would just come out and say it, which I am very much appreciate. I prefer direct. I also prefer tactful. It would be nice if she said it in a nice way. But at the same time, it should never get to that point unless you've had conversations up to that point. It should never just happen and land in your lap. Hey, here's an envelope that says, I don't love you anymore. What? Where is this coming from? You're handing this to me right now, out of the blue, when everything's been great up till now? It should never work like that. There should already be conversations happening. If the relationship has been experiencing problems, there should be a degradation in intimacy, an incremental degradation. Things getting a little bit less intimate, a little bit less connected, a little bit less communication. You're going to feel it. You're going to go through it. You're going to be in it. And you're going to experience the systematic breakdown, dissolving of the relationship. And you should already know before you get to the point where somebody says, look, it's just not working out. We've tried. We've gone through months and months, and it's not working out, or even years. It's like the employee that keeps getting reprimanded, keeps being called into the principal's office, you know, the boss, and they're told, look, you can't be doing this. Let's just say they're late. You're late every day. You can't be doing this. You have to be here by 8 o'clock. We need you here by 8. And the employee that does that should know that they are on thin ice and termination could be imminent. You could be terminated because you keep breaking the rules or breaking policy or whatever. So it shouldn't be a surprise when it happens. Although, in my experience in the corporate world, some people are surprised. What? I'm getting fired? Why? Why? What do you mean, why? Look at all this. Look at everything you've done. Look at all the rules you've broken. Look at how many times you were late. You know, I've seen this over and over again. And so, yeah, it's true. Some people are oblivious. And this is why you have to be very aware, very conscious, and being very conscientious in any sort of relationship, but especially a romantic relationship, because you are two individuals on your own paths, and you get together and live life together and share life together, but you also have your own paths. And you should. You should have your own paths. You should have your own hobbies and likes and dislikes and values and boundaries. And then you bring those two lives together and you do things together. And it's wonderful when it works. But when it doesn't work, you should know that too. You should be consciously aware of what's happening in the relationship, not just paying attention to your own path. You pay attention to their path. You pay attention to the relationship's path. I look at a relationship as three individual, or three entities, I should say. There's you, there's me, and then there's us. And us requires attention. You requires attention. And me, I require attention. You all require attention. And when there's a lack of attention for one of those entities, then you'll find the degradation that I'm talking about in that area. So if you have one person that's always focused on themselves, I'm going to do my own thing, and rarely ever talks to the other person, then all that energy is being invested in there, not into the relationship, not into the other person. But if you have one person that's always invested in the other person, like their partner, I'm always invested in you. I'm always giving to you. I'm always doting on you. I'm coddling you. I love you. And I'm going to do everything for you. Then there's an imbalance there as well, because there's not enough coming back to the other person and the relationship itself. Because I believe that both people should invest in themselves and invest into the relationship. What does that mean? That means that I enjoy doing my hobbies and working on the house and reading and playing music and things like that. That's my investment in me. I also enjoy making my girlfriend happy and seeing her happy and making sure that she's getting her needs fulfilled, and supporting her path, whatever she wants to do. Like even today, she's out doing something all day with other people, and I absolutely support that. That fills her cup. And anything that fills her cup is wonderful for the relationship. And that's the third entity. We're investing into the relationship because we're investing in ourselves, and we're bringing the best version, the most fulfilled version, as much as we can, into the relationship. And we have to see how the relationship is going on a day-to-day basis. I'm not saying you pay attention to the micro interactions in the relationship, but what's the trend? How is this relationship going? Do I feel like there's happiness in the relationship? Do I feel like there's love? Do I feel like there's intimacy? Are we happy to call each other up when we're out? She's called me twice today. Do we feel wonderful when the other person shows up when we're somewhere? Do we like going out together? You know, all this stuff that you do in a relationship. And so those investments are in each entity of a relationship. And so I went into that because the person who wrote to me, and I condensed their message and told you that their partner is saying things like, I'm just not sure. I think it's important, and this is where the truth test comes in, to apply the truth test. And this is something that I do in my head, but I would ask my girlfriend this if this was happening. Oh, that's why I went down that tangent. I was talking about my girlfriend and what love means and what relationships mean. I would apply the truth test. I would just ask her, what would happen if I told you that I was leaving the relationship? I was going to let you go and I'd be okay. How would you feel about that? There's a question, right? That's a truth question. And if she answers truthfully, it'll get to her truth. So whether she knows or not what she really feels, what I'm doing is removing myself from the equation, the formula of the relationship, which is me, her, and us. What if I remove myself from this equation and she answers that question truthfully? How would you feel if I told you I'm leaving tomorrow? I'm going to leave you, I'm going to leave us, and I'm just going to leave you alone. How would you feel about that? Now, that may be a tough question, because what if she doesn't want that at all? What if she's going through something else? And this is why communication is so important. I mean, I'm not saying you just jump to the truth test. You do have to work up to that. The workup is, what's going on? Are you okay? What's happening? You know, you've been this way for now 3 months, and you've been unsure about things for 3 months. Just tell me what's going on. And I like that approach. It's, you know, just be honest. Just tell me, you know, I'm a full-grown adult. I can handle this. Just tell me what's going on. You know, if you even have to get to that point. But if they won't say anything, or if they're afraid of telling you because of confrontation, fear of confrontation, I would probably say, you know what, it's okay. Even if you think I'm going to be angry or sad, it's okay. I just want to know what's going on. I think that's a sort of a workup question. And again, hopefully you've had basic communication around this first, but if they're being aloof, if they're being vague, ambiguous, then it is nice to ask, what's going on? Are you okay? What's happening? You've been this way for a week now. Just tell me. Let's just be honest with each other. Just tell me, is it something that I'm doing? Is it something that you want to share with me? However it works for you, whatever language you use, but that's my approach. That's what I'm going to ask my girlfriend. What's going on? You've been this way for a little while. Actually, I did ask her this when we first started seeing each other. First year we started seeing each other. We went, I don't know, 3 or 4 days where she wouldn't even look at me. And when she kissed me, it was sort of like forced and it was really quick. And I would go somewhere and when I'd walk back in, she wouldn't even look at me. And I thought, what is happening here? And so I finally did ask that question. What's going on? You know, I walk in, you don't even look at me, you barely kiss me, and it seems like you're avoiding me. What's happening? And her first response is, nothing. And I said, no. I'm in my mind, I'm thinking, you're not going to get away with it that easy. There is something going on. And this is something you have to be aware of, too, is that the person that says nothing, you do have to be prepared to say, no, there is something going on. Because I feel different around you. You feel different to me. You used to do this and now you do this instead, or you don't do this anymore. These are the kind of conversations that are important to have. I don't feel the same around you. There's something different. And if you can tell what's different, like I could tell she wasn't looking at me. You never look at me. What's going on? That's not right. This is not how it's been. So something has changed. And so that's how I brought this stuff up, is that I felt something has changed. We always feel when something changes. Something has changed. What's going on? And if we can figure out what that change is, even better, because we can say, hey, look, you used to do this, and now you don't. What's going on? And they may avoid it still. They may say, well, I just don't want to do that anymore. What if they say something like that? If that happens, then, yeah, you can say, well, it doesn't feel like we're connected. Doesn't feel like we are connecting at a deeper level like we used to. And they, again, might avoid it. They may not tell you. And they may need space. And you might have to ask them that. Do you need some space? Do you want some space? And so these are the kind of workup questions that I like to use just in case we're ever in that situation. And that's what I asked my girlfriend. I said, you know, we've been not connecting lately. You haven't been looking at me. And she finally said, okay, you know, when you said this like 3 days ago, well, I was really angry about that. And I thought, whoa, that's what this is about? Because I had no idea I even upset her. And so I said, no, that's not what I meant at all. Here's what that was about. And I'm so sorry. I didn't know you took it that way. And she said, I took that wrong. And then I laid it on her. I said, why didn't you tell me? We've been disconnected all this time. And I felt like so alone in this house. And she said, I didn't want to upset you. I didn't want to cause any trouble. I thought, okay, this is something you may have heard me say before if you've been listening a while. This is what we need to do. If you're holding back something that you think will upset me, tell me anyway, because I would rather you upset me than feel completely alone in this house. And she was uncomfortable with that, and she finally said, really? Are you sure? And I said, yes, I would rather know what you're upset about than not know anything and feel ignored and neglected. She said, okay, but I'm going to be honest with you. And I said, yes, that's what I want. I want you to be honest. If you're angry with me, tell me. I'm angry with you. If I did something, tell me. You did something and I'm upset. Great. And so we agreed to that, and she did come through. She did eventually start feeling more comfortable telling me this stuff, because I didn't yell at her. I didn't say anything like that. And when she would say what she was upset about, I said, thank you for telling me. I think that's a great response to tell someone when they're upset at you. I'm upset at you. I'm angry at you. And instead of becoming defensive, say, wow, thank you for telling me. I'm so glad you told me, and I'm so sorry that I upset you, if that's how you feel. Because I don't want to upset my girlfriend. I want her to be happy. Her being happy makes the relationship better. Her being happy makes me happy. When one person's not happy, both people will not be happy. Or at least they probably won't have a close relationship, because if one person's happy and the other person's like, I don't care if she's happy or not, I'm happy, you don't have a relationship anymore. It's not balanced. So I prefer balanced relationships. So anyway, the truth test comes in after all these warm-up questions and trying to figure out what's going on. And then you finally get to the point where you don't want to live like this anymore. You don't want to live in this void of no communication or can't figure out what's going on. So you have to bring it up. Let me just try this on you. If I told you that maybe we should not see each other anymore, would that make you feel better? I mean, that's a tough thing to talk about. I get it. But, you know, you could approach it a little differently. You can create an alternative, like, what would happen if I died tomorrow? What would you do? Whoa, you know, bring that question up. That's a big question, but you can watch their response. Well, if you died tomorrow, I don't know. I guess I would start doing my hobbies again. That's interesting, because why weren't they doing their hobbies before? Are you kind of interfering with what's going on in their life? You can find stuff out like that. And I'm not saying the truth test is a great idea. It might actually create other conversations. Somebody might actually say, why would you say that? It has nothing to do with you. This is nothing to do with you. Well, just tell me then. That's what would be my response. Well, tell me. You haven't been telling me. You haven't been communicating with me. What's going on? So I hope this helps this person that wrote. And maybe if you're going through something and it helps you, I don't know. Maybe you'll never want to administer that truth test, because it might be information that's kind of hard to hear, because the truth test can reveal hard truths that you may not be ready for, may not want to hear. But it's much better than just being in complete darkness, not knowing what's going on. There's a point where you have to know. You have to know what's going on. You just drive yourself crazy otherwise. Thanks so much for joining me, and I appreciate you. I will be right back with my thank yous and my goodbyes and my final words right after this. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Overwhelmed Brain. I want to thank the patrons of the week, Anna, Harriet, Andreas, I don't know if I said that right, Paige, Emily, Brian, Somaya, Komal, oh, another one, sorry, Donald, Stephen, Daisy. I apologize if I mispronounce any of your names, but I am grateful for you. Thank you so much for your support. These are the patrons of the week that I read new names every week, people that are contributing financially to the show. Thank you, patrons. I appreciate each and every one of you. They found value in the show, and they decided to give. And if you are in a position where you can give and you want to give, head over to moretob.com, where you can become a monthly patron. And I've got some goodies over there as well, like 90 episodes you've never heard and a few other resources and content over there. moretob.com. Thank you again, patrons. And I received, looks like it might be a review. Somebody wrote, T.O.B., The Overwhelmed Brain, a life changer. I hope this message finds you well. I stumbled across your podcast, T.O.B., today, and I listened to the first episode, and it nailed me between the eyes. The episode spoke of becoming a better person, but embracing forgiveness of self while taking accountability of who and where you were in life. That was the catalyst for change. More personally, the delivery of the content was eerie. And that I felt like you were bringing up many issues that applied in my recent recovery timeline. Honestly, I'm commuting downtown and didn't know whether to rejoice or cry or both at the revelations you dropped in your content. I too had a marriage crumble only to be followed by a deep, dark depression. I too experienced the things you shared in your journey. And he goes on, truth, own your inventory. I've done a lot of work rebuilding my mental framework while experiencing love again. Just got remarried while sweeping up the embers of depression. I matter. Anyone who's human matters, and no one is beyond getting help. People need to have a morsel of hope if they do want to survive and become better. People are worth it, and we have to earn our way back sometimes. Recovery isn't a freebie. Anyway, I could ramble on, but my intent was just to say thank you. I do believe God has me on a path, and I've recently prayed for a healthy circle of people with wise counsel to enter my life. Little did I know that one of you would be running an amazing podcast. Your work really matters, Paul. Thank you. Many blessings of prosperity to you. What an amazing message. Thank you so much. I am honored. I am grateful for all your words, and I am just so thankful that you wrote this and shared this with me. It makes my day. And I'm so happy that you have found a path, or you're on a path that is working out great. And I like to tell people and you that I take the path of Morpheus, the path of Morpheus in the Matrix, where I just show you the door. You're the one that has to walk through it. And if you walk through it, what are your results? You can't find out what your results will be until you walk through it. Here's the door. Try to walk through it. Just like the stuff I'm talking about in this episode. You know, I'm going to bring up the truth test. There's the door. Do you want to walk through it? Do you want to know the truth? And sometimes that's what it takes. It takes that leap of faith. It feels risky. It feels risky to do some of this stuff. But what I like is closure. I like to get to closure as soon as possible, which is why I do things like the truth test. And I don't say, hey, I'm going to administer the truth test on you. I don't do that. I just call it something so you remember it. And hopefully it works out for you. And sometimes you'll learn a hard truth that you don't want to hear. And that's, you might have to make a change in your life. But I like to look at how my life is working out now. And if it's not working out, maybe a change is good. For example, the long-term relationship I had with a girl back way in the 90s, and we lived together for about 13 years, and the last 2 years, it wasn't working out. And why would I want to continue with something that wasn't working out, or at least the way it was? I would rather have it work out, but if I applied the truth test back then, and I asked her, what would happen if I left? What would she say? And she'd probably say, I don't know, I think I'd be okay. And she probably would, because the last 2 years of our relationship were falling apart. But I bring that up because we weren't happy. We weren't connecting. We weren't intimate. And how long should that go on for? And I think of things differently now. I don't want anything to go on for, geez, more than a couple days. If something like that happened today, I'd be asking, what's going on? What's wrong? Back then, I didn't mind waiting years. I don't do that anymore. I like finding out the truth as soon as possible, getting to closure as soon as possible. I like walking through that door no matter what. If there's a cliff on the other side, I guess I'm falling because I need to know. I can't stay this way. I need to know what I'm going to do with my life. I can't stay in a rut. I can't be stagnant. I have to keep moving forward, or at least if I'm on a good path, stay on that path. And maybe that path has a little log cabin on the side, and I can stay in that log cabin for a while with people I care about. And those people, if they add to my life, there's probably no reason to change. I'll just keep doing what I'm doing, and if it's all working, then that's great. But I do believe in momentum. If you don't have momentum to get through the next day, week, month, and year, then you have to build it. How do you build it? You find out if what works now still works tomorrow. And if something doesn't seem to be working out now, why not? Find out the truth. Don't go into denial. Don't think that it's going to go away by itself. Just find out. Do what you can to find out. And I know sometimes you can't find out. Sometimes you ask direct questions and people avoid them, or they say indirect answers and it doesn't help at all. There's a point where if you're not getting the answers that you need to hear to move on, then you might need to move on. You might need to say, look, I need to take care of myself because what used to happen here isn't happening anymore. And I don't know where you are and you won't share it with me. So I'm going to make the decision to do what I need to do for me. Again, it's going to take some buildup to get to that point. Of course, communication is key. You just want to continue trying to talk, trying to get the honest answers, trying to make the situation work or the relationship work or the job work, and being open, being honest, and being okay with what might be a harsh truth. A harsh truth is what you might need to hear in order for you to make a positive change in your life, even though the change might be difficult. But sometimes good things come at cost. Like this person said, recovery comes at a cost. Just like good changes can come at a cost sometimes. Not always. It doesn't mean it's 100% true. Sometimes you can heal and grow without too much loss, that cost thing. But sometimes it does take an investment. Time, energy, money. You just have to be willing to do what it takes to get to the next stage of life, whatever that is. Anyway, thank you again to that person who wrote. Thank you for listening to another episode of the show. Thank you to Kevin McLeod for some of the music transitions in this episode. And I just want to remind you, I'm going to get right to the point, right to the end, where I say, just keep an open mind. This is how you step into your power so that you can create the life you want. Always take steps to grow and evolve. You are powerful beyond measure. And above all, and this is something I absolutely know to be true about you, you are amazing.